This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Gareth Porter, whom you've heard many times on Takes on the World, is an award-winning independent investigative journalist and historian who's been writing on U.S. national security policy since the Vietnam War, and in recent years has been examining U.S. efforts to change the government of Iran, which led to his book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, published in 2014. Today, he is one of a handful of journalists you won't hear on NPR or see on MSNBC or CNN, nor see quoted in the mainstream media, who have attempted to defuse the drive for regime change in Iran and expose the hawkish elements in the Trump White House that have been pushing the U.S. toward doing that through another devastation war, which is what we'll be talking about today. Welcome once again, Gareth Porter, to Takes on the World.
Hi again, Jeff. Glad to be back on your show.
And I'm glad to have you back. If we thought that the so-called intelligence that justified the Iraq War, which was a disaster, what can we say about how John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and the acting soon-to-be defense secretary from Boeing, Patrick Shanahan, have justified the U.S. buildup for war in Iran and how the media has been reporting it?
Well, you know, I bow to no one in my view of the George W. Bush era, quote, intelligence, unquote, used to justify the invasion of Iraq as a deception. But I believe that this current set of policymakers in the Trump White House and administration are even worse. I think it's an even more shabby, deceptive piece of work that they have foisted on the public. And of course, as we always see happen, the corporate media have lapped it up without the slightest, there's been a slight twinge of questioning here and there, but for the most part, this has been accepted as the truth without serious scrutiny at all. And that is, I'm afraid to say, that's what has endangered the security of the American people now very seriously. I think we are we're very far along in terms of a crisis that is entirely artificial, and which Bolton and his allies, particularly Pompeo, but Shanahan clearly is now quite complicit in this plot. Those people are really responsible for the most serious threat of war that we have faced since the beginning of the Iraq War. And I include there the effort by Dick Cheney in 2007 to actually push the idea that the United States should retaliate for the kind of proxy attack that has now been proposed by Bolton and Pompeo. Of course, he was squashed by the Pentagon in 2007, so it didn't go anywhere. And I think that this situation is even more serious than that one.
Well, it's interesting. You did have people appointed by Trump in the military, people like James Mattis and General Kelly and H.R. McMaster, who didn't see Iran as being the threat that it was and opposed the ending of the Iran nuclear deal by Trump, and now those are all gone. And it seems like there's a clear path, except that Bolton has been so heavy-handed that even it seems some Republicans are kind of queasy about it. And as I reported earlier, Bolton was really appointed to that post by Sheldon Adelson, Trump's big funder. So there's a real problem if Trump tries to get rid of Bolton because his main funder might not appreciate or want to put money into his next election campaign. And this seems to be a domestic issue, which again looks like the possibility of war. Even you mentioned that it was a month after the Israelis came to Washington and was publicized in the Israeli press. I met with John Bolton, someone from Mossad intelligence, to give so-called intelligence which you tear apart in a couple of your articles. It was a month later that the New York Times had an article on its 11th page, at the bottom of the page, acknowledging that intelligence had come from Israel. But then today's paper, on this very important story, in which Mike Pompeo and Shanahan, minus Bolton, met with Congress, both houses, yesterday, it was buried on page 10. That's for a major story, possible war, on page 10, and no mention of Israel at all. How do you account for that?
Yeah, this is a very important pattern that you're identifying here, that the headline stories, front page, big headline stories, in always essentially unspool the narrative that the U.S. has credible, real intelligence here, that Iran is posing a new threat to American personnel and allies in the Middle East, whereas those small bits and pieces that suggest otherwise, that suggest that there are serious reasons to doubt that there was any such intelligence, or that if there was intelligence, that the source of it may help to explain why it suggested this kind of narrative, that is to say, it came from the Israelis, that's buried in a single sentence, in a small paragraph, in an out-of-the-way place. I think you're absolutely right that is a significant element of the problem that we face here in the way in which the media has been covering this story. And indeed, I think that the real story behind this so-called credible intelligence is precisely that it was provided by the Israelis in a meeting in mid-April at the White House, which Bolton announced on his Twitter account. He announced that he had met with the National Security Advisor of Israel, Ben Shabbat, but he, of course, gave no clue as to what actually happened in the meeting. And we now know, we knew actually at the time, or soon after that, I should say, that what happened was that Mossad had provided the U.S. delegation, which included Bolton as well as apparently Gina Haspel, or at least high-ranking intelligence officials and high-ranking State Department and Pentagon officials, with so-called information, so-called intelligence, that suggested that there was reason to believe that the Iranians were preparing for some sort of an attack. Now, of course, that was the interpretation provided by Mossad, with all of the self-interested reasons behind that, reasoning behind that. In fact, we know that what they actually had was fragments of information which didn't prove anything at all, didn't show anything at all, would have to be put into perspective against the entire array of facts that one had available. And of course, what was really going on there was that Bolton was forcing a process which essentially absorbed the Israeli interpretation of this and called it intelligence. And that's why I say that this was an even more flagrant violation of the truth, a more flagrant lie than what happened in the run-up to the Iraq War, where there was definitely an effort to push a false interpretation of the infamous aluminum tubes, but at least there were aluminum tubes there that some of the analysts at the CIA, for whatever reason, and I'm afraid the reasons were not the right ones, were willing to say, yeah, this is suspect. This must mean that they have a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. But I think this is clearly much more flagrant, much more clearly an out-and-out lie pushed intentionally by Bolton and with Pompeo and Shanahan going along with this for their own apparent reasons, political and bureaucratic reasons.
Well, probably nothing is more flagrant or ridiculous than the discovery in Dow is not large military boats, but some Iranian missile launchers, but just Iranian missiles with no launchers. And these Iranian missiles were supposedly going to be fired from these dhows at U.S. Navy or Saudi ships. And they're so extraordinary on the face of it. You don't have to be a military or weapons expert to know how ridiculous that is. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Jeff. I mean, this was an absolutely absurd interpretation. Again, clearly simply a rationalization of the kind of policy that they were urging on the United States. They were claiming that the pictures, aerial photos, that were taken either by the Israelis or by the Americans, it's unclear as to who actually had the pictures, and it doesn't matter, pictures of some missiles being loaded into fishing dhows, were somehow evidence that the Iranians were preparing for an attack on the United States. Now, in my article, I point out that a leading independent scholar or specialist on missile proliferation, writing for the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, has observed that that the idea that the Iranians were preparing to have the option of firing these missiles from boats makes absolutely no strategic sense. First of all, of course, they would have had to find some way to launch them from boats, and they would have to test them, and there's no indication that they had any such mechanism or that they'd ever done any testing, which would have been clearly something that could have been picked up. And beyond that, more fundamentally, it makes no sense strategically for Iran, even if they were going to, you know, if they had a plan to attack American ships, they wouldn't do it from fishing dhows. They have anti-ship missiles that they can fire from land or from one of their islands offshore that would be much more secure, much safer from American air power or from other missiles that could be launched against them, because they could be disguised or they would be underground. And so the whole idea is fanciful and absurd. And the fact that no one in the corporate media saw fit to even ask the most fundamental questions should cause anybody who reads the media to question their good faith from here on and to only read them for the purpose of scouting out their lies and pointing them out to the rest of the world.
I should point out that my guest here is Gareth Porter. His latest article is "Do Iranian Threats," that's threats in quote, "signal organized U.S.-Israel subterfuge," published in the American Conservative, which is an excellent magazine and carries, among other magazines, Gareth's work. Extraordinary. What a question that didn't seem to be asked, maybe it wasn't at least in report in the New York Times, why was not John Bolton present for this briefing with members of Congress? He was in a position of national security advisor that didn't require Senate confirmation, which he quite likely would not have received. But they should have demanded that he be there, and there seems to be no objection or mention in the paper. But an extraordinary comment by the Boeing executive, and who's going to be our next defense minister, Mr. Shanahan, Patrick Shanahan, in which he said, this is New York Times today, quote, "We have deterred attacks based on our reposturing of assets, deterred attacks against American forces." Mr. Shanahan said after briefing lawmakers, "Our biggest focus at this point is to prevent Iranian miscalculation. We do not want the situation to escalate. This is about deterrence, not about war." And this is like, again, as you point out, this is turning everything upside down. And what does it say? Go on.
Yeah, that's right. It's turning things upside down. Or another way of looking at it is the famous sort of joke about the guy who claimed that he was a hero because he had driven all the elephants out of the area of the village, whereupon everyone observed that there are no elephants around here, after which, to which he responded, well, that just goes to show how successful I was. And that's kind of what the what Shanahan and the others are now trying to do. they're trying to claim that, that, oh, well, the lack of threat is because we have succeeded in deterring the Iranians.
It is extraordinary, but what the complicity of the media in this is what's really frightening, because we saw the same thing in the run-up to the Iraq War. The New York Times actually, I believe, did apologize, but it seems not to have learned anything. And this is our media across the board. Somehow, I mean, I saw a photograph of John Bolton standing with the head of this Mossad official, national security official from Israel, and he tweeted about it, and it was well covered in the Israeli press in English. And I'm sure there are enough employees at our major media outlets who monitor the Israeli press, because after all, it's our strongest ally and democratic ally in the Middle East. We're joined at the hip, according to Joe Biden. And yet this is something that continues to occur. You mentioned, and I had mentioned earlier in my program years when it happened, you talk about the Israeli-U.S. Getting together, meeting together with intelligence officials, dealing with Iran even before Trump took office, and McMaster was still in there, and they came up with a series of departments and plans to target Iran all over the region. And you mentioned this in your article, but this has never been mentioned in the U.S. media, and it was not a secret in the Israeli press. It was mentioned. Please comment.
That's right.
That.
You know, Jeff, this is a remarkable fact about the Israeli and U.S. press. Despite the fact that Israel is, in many ways, the most repressive nation, one of the most repressive nations, if not the most repressive nations in the world, the Israeli press is freer to report and discuss this kind of very sensitive issue than the American press is. And that is a fact that really should cause Americans concerned about the nature of the press in this country to think very hard about what is wrong and what needs to be done about it. The fact is that the leading national security correspondent in Israel, arguably, the former correspondent for Haaretz, now writing for Channel 13 and also writing for Axios, has continued to report on this extraordinary secret agreement between the United States and Israel, as you say, was reached originally in December of 2017. Between McMaster and Ben Shabbat, the two respective national security advisors, but it arrived at a joint strategy for trying to oppose Iran, both politically and in other ways, diplomatically and in other ways. And it laid out 4 points, 4 working groups that were supposed to continue to work and evidently have continued to meet, and which have continued to produce joint policies. Now, to my mind, this is the single most important national security policy story that has never been reported in the American press. And I believe that members of Congress need to ask very searching, probing questions of the Trump administration about precisely what the significance of this is and how it has played a role in the unfolding of this crisis with Iran.
Well, they covered up a number of things shortly after the election, as I reported. You probably may have seen it on the YouTube as well. The Israeli-American Council had a meeting, a conference in Florida, in which Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer were on stage with Haim Saban, an Israeli big funder of the Democratic Party, but the whole shindig was paid for by Sheldon Adelson, in which Nancy Pelosi bragged about and mentioned all the committee chairs in Congress that she had appointed who were going to help Israel. This, of course, did not get any mention in the U.S. press, nor do any of the speeches any of our politicians ever make at any AIPAC conventions. It makes you kind of think that there might be some control in there that American people need to know about but aren't going to hear about on their media. And my program is maybe there's maybe a couple of programs that you'll find in the States where you'll be discussing this, right?
I think that's about right. Maybe more than a couple, but very few in any case. And indeed, I think you put your finger on, again, the fundamental problem in the American media, which is it's not just a problem that applies to Israel, but it certainly applies in spades to the whole question of U.S. policy toward Israel, the extraordinary influence that the Israeli government has over U.S. policy in the Middle East, and of course, particularly towards Israel. And I would just say that, this demands much more attention than it's gotten. And I don't necessarily hold to the idea that the owners of the newspapers have put pressure on journalists not to report this. I think that it's a much more implicit kind of dog whistle kind of effect that we have here. That journalists who have been around for a few years see the way issues are reported. They know who is to be cited, who is to be quoted, who's not to be cited or quoted, what issue is to be reported, what issue isn't. And that's the way the system works. And it's not just on Israel, but everything else having to do with foreign policy and national security. It's a system that is extraordinarily sensitive to implicit lines, red lines, that journalists cannot and do not cross.
You're saying, in a sense, it becomes an act of self-censorship. The journalists know
absolutely,
from experience
absolutely.
What they can and cannot write about and to keep their jobs.
Which doesn't mean that there's never a case where senior editors don't intervene. Of course, we know that they do. But I think that those are very few and far between, and it only takes a few over a period of years for the lines to become clear to those who remain on the job, who get promoted, and who get more responsibility. And it's a process that does weed out anybody at an earlier stage, anybody who asks too many questions.
I don't know if you're familiar with it, but back in 1979, the Washington Post had a number of stories that were very critical of Israel and its policies in southern Lebanon. And the one of the heads of the local Washington Jewish Community Federation went to Ben Bradley, the managing editor of the Washington Post, very famous managing editor, and demanded that someone from the Jewish community in Washington be allowed to monitor the newsroom to see what was going on there. And over
I've
the,
never heard that one.
But over the over the protests of the members of the newsroom, Bradley let someone from the Washington Jewish community sit in the newsroom and watch how stories were written and edited. And this, and since that period, the Washington Post has been rolled over for Israel. And people don't. I'm old enough to recall that story, and it's an amazing story because it just makes a case for what I have made on my program. And the reason I talk about and I'm preoccupied with the subject is because you can't find it anywhere else in the mainstream media.
Yes, well, you've certainly found a story that appears to make the case very strongly that something more than simply a dog whistle or implicit lines have influenced the coverage of Israel. I certainly have to admit that.
What do you think, since the New York Times buried the story on page 10, which should have been a major story, where the Secretary of State and the presumably the next defense minister speak to both houses of Congress, and it's not on page one about a potential war in the Middle East, and it's not on the front page, and it's buried on page 10.
It's very strange. Yeah, I don't know precisely what the thinking would be here. I hesitate to try to interpret it. Perhaps because there's material in the story that brings out skepticism about the line that has been taken by the administration on Iran. A young Democratic, I presume he's young, I had not seen the name before, a Democrat from Arizona, who expressed doubt or skepticism about the line that was being taken, about the legitimacy of the so-called intelligence that was being talked about. I just don't know, but I think it is certainly a question that deserves scrutiny and analysis. That's for sure.
How much of an issue do you think this will be, as well as our support for Israel will be, in the 2020 elections? We've had, it was not reported in the mainstream media, but again in the Israeli press, that Move On, which is the largest grassroots organization, essentially democratic organization with millions of members, made two endorsements for 2020, one of whom was Ilhan Omar, and the other was Rashid Tlaib, based on the votes of the members of Move On in their respective districts. This did not get any notice at all in the mainstream U.S. media, but it seems to indicate that there's going to be a real conflict within the Democratic Party on this issue in the coming months. What's your take on that?
I think you're absolutely right, Jeff, that this is going to be the subject of increasing debate, more pressure on the Democrats in Congress from their constituencies, from their constituents. There's clearly much greater dissent, particularly within the Democratic Party's base, on a U.S. Sort of slavish following of Israeli policy toward Iran or toward Middle Eastern issues, particularly the Palestinian issue, but also Iran, and doubt about the degree to which the United States is uncritically supporting the Israelis on a series of issues. And I don't know exactly how that plays out, but I think it's a safe bet that there is going to be greater discussion, certainly among grassroots voters, of these issues than there ever has been in recent memory. So I think that is an important thing to watch, for sure.
What is your view in terms of the current situation? That is the New York Times trying now to downplay this because they realize that the story has been overblown by Bolton and Pompeo?
You know, there have been hints for the last most of the last week in a couple of the stories that the Times has published that not everybody covering these stories for the Times takes the so-called intelligence at face value at all, that there are, I think, substantive doubts about the legitimacy of the case that's been made. You know, as I said, there were doubts being expressed by some of the people who were briefed yesterday. And so I think that you're beginning to see the first signs over the past week, and I suspect the signs are going to start growing, of doubts that are prevalent both among rank-and-file members in Congress, as well as some of the people who've been assigned to cover this story. Now, you know, I think David Sanger is going to be a true believer. He's not going to cross the line and start expressing any doubt. But I think some of the other people assigned to the story may well be unwilling to continue to just broadcast the line that they started with in the first few days. Now that it's become clear that it's much more complicated, they don't want to have egg all over their faces. They don't want to really look bad. And I think that it is going to look bad for anybody of any intelligence reading the coverage to continue that spirit of the first week or so of the coverage. Now that there's more details that have come out that clearly raise serious doubts about the legitimacy of the claims that were made by Bolton, Pompeo, and Shanahan.
At least that's a positive, because we saw nothing like that in the run-up to the Iraq War. What I'm curious to watch and get your thoughts on, up to now, as far as I can tell, the only Democrat candidate for Congress, for president, who has spoken on policing critically is Tulsi Gabbard. Do you expect the other ones to be forced to take positions on this as the debates start, or can they continue to ignore it and just look at the domestic issues?
I think that, yes, they are going to be forced to take positions, and that, I think that's going to be really interesting now to see how it plays out. Because some of the candidates will certainly fall down on the side of basically saying, yes, Iran is a threat, and not backing away from that in a political way. And some others may well decide that they're better off expressing doubt and coming down on the side of saying, this policy is moving in the wrong direction. I think my suspicion is that more of them will be edging toward the latter position, and the more hardliners are going to be finding themselves isolated.
Well, let's hope so. I know there's a big push to by the party chiefs to get Joe Biden as the nominee, and my feeling, personal feeling, is that the party chiefs would rather lose the election than lose control of the party to the younger ones who are coming up and expressing opinions that have gone against the DNC traditionally.
Very good point. I agree. Yeah.
because the party, there's a party mechanism. It's interesting. You don't find Democratic Republican Party offices in cities around the country. They appear around election time, like you do in European countries, where all the parties have their local offices. They're part of the communities,
yeah,
both across the board. But it'll be curious to see, and I'm sure that the Nancy Pelosi and the others are quite concerned, and Biden and others, about the upstarts in the Democratic Party, and the role that MoveOn is taking independently. And I think probably on this issue, they'll be quite active in a positive way. I mean, that's what it would seem from my perspective, as a kind of.
Well, the easy position to take, of course, for Democrats is to say we're against war, we're against policies that were going to get us into a war, and then avoid the larger picture that has been drawn, not just by the Trump administration and the leading hawks. Of course, led by Bolton, but really started long before that and embraced quite completely or nearly completely by the Obama administration about the malign actor that they claim Iran has been and continues to be, that everything that Iran does in the Middle East represents malign actions, that Iran is the world's leading sponsor of terrorism. And that it's responsible for all the wars in the Middle East. It's an absolutely absurd position that that no self-respecting member of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, for that matter, running for office should be taking publicly. But I'm afraid that is the default position. And the question is whether any of the candidates, except possibly for Tulsi Gabbard, will be willing to have anything critical to say about the narrative that has been the basis for being able to get away with the absurd storyline that has been put out over the past 2 or 3 weeks by the Trump administration.
Well, actually, Gareth, you know, that what you said, this is like a mantra. You cannot talk about Iran without saying it's a leading state sponsor of terrorism. And no journalist ever asked for evidence examples of that state terror,
when we
know that the Saudis would certainly contest anyone for that job. Israel's played a role as well.
Beyond that, just to make my point clear here, no one ever points out that a series of incidents that are attributed to Iran, including the Khobar Towers bombing of 1996 and the bombing of the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in 1994, there's absolutely no evidence in either case linking Iran, any objective or a serious real evidence linking Iran to those bombings. And the evidence trail leads in both cases, certainly in the latter case, to al-Qaeda. And in the former case, I've done a lot of investigation of the Buenos Aires bombing, and I believe that there's every reason to believe that it was done by anti-Semite Argentine members of the intelligence and police the intelligence and the police services of the Argentine government, who are notorious for mistreatment of Jewish prisoners during the Dirty War, and we know that Buenos Aires was the leading center of anti-Semitism in the entire world in terms of incidents of hate crimes against Jews, has been continued to be the case for decades. So, I just want to point out that there is an overwhelming overhang of lies that is behind that part of the narrative about Iran.
That's a good point you brought up, because I remember reading Sonny Jacobo Timmerman, an Israeli progressive who was a prisoner in Argentina as a journalist, and they reveled in their anti-Semitism, as his captors did, even while supporting Israel, the irony is. Gareth, I want to thank you again for being our guest on Takes on the World. You're always a great interview and really informative, and and our listeners here are very privileged to have a chance to listen to you again. So your article, I wanted to say, your article, "Do Iranian Threats Signal Organized U.S.-Israel Subterfuges on American Conservative?" And another earlier article, "John Bolton's Nefarious Plot for War with Iran" is on Truth Dig. Is there one website where they can get articles that you write, because you write for Consortium News and antiwar.com?
Jeff, if people want to just go to one website which has all my articles, it's antiwar.com.
Well, Gareth, thanks again for being our guest, and look forward to our next conversation on Takes on the World. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Jeff. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.